Thanks a lot, Jesse. I'm kind of an asshole. Or at first, anyway. This is really an honor to be able to talk to all you guys. It's weird for me to be speaking about spirituality in front of people who I look up to as, you know, people who are much more spiritual than I. So hopefully this remedial talk will maybe remind you of how you were at some point, or get a little something out of that. But I'd like to invite all of you to put on your helmets now so it doesn't make a mess when I blow your mind. I was... I got here through the usual channels, I guess. I drank a whole lot as I probably started relatively late, junior high school, I guess, and enjoyed getting really loaded all the time, as off as I could, as you know, when I could sneak off and get away with it. Carried that into college when I really could turn into a full-time drinker. I didn't have adult supervision, so I really, that was in my, you know, my first pass through college was what I really learned was how to drink and do drugs properly for a person like me. And I didn't get a whole lot out of school at that point, and then, you know, kind of stumbled my way through, got out, and then knew I was probably a little out of control at that point, but I just figured, you know, I'm going to get a job now and everything will just normalize and I'll, you know, everything will just cool down. But it turned out that having no homework and a lot of money is not a good recipe for stopping drinking. So that this just continued for much longer. I'm holding it together enough to stay employed, to keep relationships sort of going for the most part. It was funny when listening to Alan the other night as he was starting off telling his story and how he kind of started doing the cocaine and that became a big problem. And I'm thinking, like, stop that because that's what I'm going to talk about because you're ruining my story. But I had a really, really very similar experience to that where I started doing cocaine pretty late, actually, when it was really not that cute anymore for a person to be doing cocaine. But it kind of started so that I could drink more. Try explaining that one at work. You know, the reason I was doing cocaine is because I was drinking so much, I was kind of getting stumbly and blacking out. But if I snorted a bunch of cocaine, I can drink way longer. So that's that made sense to me. Which is, should have been a red flag probably, but it was ignored. And so that kind of quickly got me in more and more trouble with relationships and more trouble with work. And, you know, I'm kind of justifying this because I'm like, I haven't gotten fired. I've got a job. I show up all the time. And people who aren't doing what I'm doing, like doing cocaine and getting loaded on Tuesday night, are suckers. They're not enjoying life to the fullest. They're not getting this wonderful experience that I'm getting, and they're idiots. And this was kind of my go-to mentality for most things was that I knew best, and whatever I'm doing is the right thing to do. And if you're not doing it, you're an idiot. And that, you know, served me not well. So I'm fine. You know, I'm married. I've got a lot of friends that are really kind of, you know, they're good people. I assume they're drinking like I am. But what I'm starting to, you know, after getting sober, I'd look back at how I was doing this stuff, and I was starting off after work with like some work people. I would go out for happy hour, and then maybe they'd all go home, and then I would move on to go see a rock show or something and meet up with a whole different crew of people. And then they would leave, and then I would move on to the, my after-hours drug friends. And I'm thinking, like, I'm basically with these same people the whole time, right? So everybody's doing exactly what I'm doing, but really, they're not. They all kind of had shorter spans and a little bit of control. And I was just burning through everybody. And this, you know, just keeps escalating and escalating. I'm feeling more and more like the world is against me. People don't get me. I'm just this, you know, I'm so cool and dangerous, and you know, people just are not understanding my vibe, man. it's yeah, it's very healthy thinking, but so I keep shedding off people, you know. People kind of don't want to be around me, but I'm also in the back of my mind ashamed of what I'm doing, and so I'm kind of staying away from people too. And it's getting I end up, you know, I end up divorced. I like to think it was because I fell in love with another person, which is, you know, a great thing when you're married, of course, but so that makes a good reason. But then really looking back on it, it was you know, poison from the very beginning, just because of my behavior, my drinking, my drug use. I was never really connected to that marriage. So I'm out of that. There's a long version of the story. I can, if you want to hear it later, let me know. But from that, I wound up in this basement. I was kicked out of the house, and I wound up in this basement room in this house by Green Lake, which we were kind of referring to as the Green Lake home for wayward bachelors. And there was this bar in the basement that was right across the hallway from my bedroom, and it was, you know, decorated with this pine board paneling. So we were calling that the Naughty Pine Lounge. And and so I essentially was living in this basement across the hall from a bar that was open 24 hours a day, and there was drug dealers there on shifts, basically, kind of hanging out. It ended up at the peak being seven people living there, two dogs, a Winnebago in the backyard. And this is the house on Green Lake that's the only one with like the dead lawn and just like looks horrible. It's literally like right across the street from the lake, which I lived there for like 6 months, and I think I walked around the lake one time, and really went and sat by the lake twice, maybe. But I was in the basement a lot with the curtains closed and suffering. And at this house, I was circling the drain pretty rapidly. I almost died there. I'm also diabetic, and I wasn't managing that at all. I wound up with. Over after one big long weekend bender, I had my blood sugar, which is normally supposed to be, you know, about 150 or less. I kind of went into, I guess you could call it a coma. I don't know. But my roommates finally, after I was unresponsive for a while, you know, carried me out of the basement and kind of shoved me out of the car at the hospital and took off. And I woke up in the hospital with a catheter and an IV insulin pump and a doctor sitting there scornfully looking at me like, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" And my blood sugar level was 1,500 at that point. It was like 10 times the legal limit, and they said it. They told me that was a record for Ballard Swedish, so got that going for me. But at that time, I was able to blame that on diabetes. You know, that wasn't because of my drinking or drugging. That had nothing to do with that. So I kind of convalesced for a week or so at my ex-wife's house, who was still associating with me somewhat, and then went back to the Naughty Pine and started it all up again. Just ridiculous, ridiculous behavior until finally. There was a friend of mine who lived there, who I knew for many years. He was kind of in a similar situation to me. He'd been kicked out by his girlfriend, and we'd hang out together in the basement doing a lot of drugs and you know, bitching about how the world was mistreating us. And we finally both we were kind of the cokeheads in the house, and then there were the stoner contingent as well, and there was always some friction with that because on two very different wavelengths most of the time. But that all kind of came to a head, and so my friend moved out, and then I moved out shortly after that into my own place where I could really do whatever I wanted. And then So my buddy got sober, and I'd kind of kept an eye on him because I knew he had done exactly what I was doing, and I see him starting to improve a little bit. So I end up with this, with the girl that I had, you know, fallen in love with, broken up with my wife over. She has a very strict no drug policy, which meant I had to do a lot of lying because I wasn't going to stop that. And she was drinking, I was drinking. We were in this kind of toxic, you know, party, 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 love, love, fight, 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 whatever. You know, I'm sure you're all kind of familiar with that stuff. And then it came to, this was maybe 6 months after I'd moved out of that house. I'm supposed to be on a Saturday meeting up with my girlfriend. This friend of hers is in from out of town. We were going to go to lunch. But the night before that, we'd had some minor tiff about something. I don't even know what it was. And so that led to me calling the drug dealer, staying out all night. I'm up all night. I remember this vividly. I'm sitting on the floor of my living room, coffee table in front of me. Here's the last of my cocaine, my last of my beer, and the alarm clock's going off in my bedroom, and I'm supposed to be getting up right now to go do this, to go meet these people. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't tell another lie. I got to the point where there was no way I was going to be able to cover this up. And so I had to call her, tell her the truth. I can't do it. I've been up all night. She's like, "We're finished." Click, you know, slams the phone down. And the next call I made was to that friend of mine who had gotten sober. And he'd essentially been waiting for that call. He was just like, "All right, I know what to do." And he took me to my first meeting, which was at Salmon Bay in Ballard. And the next day, we went to the Triangle for the first time. That very first meeting, is Donnie still here? He was at my very first meeting. And I remember that being this traumatic thing where I had no contact with sobriety at all. And I this friend of mine who had, you know, I'd stayed in touch with was the only sober person I knew. So I'd never had any exposure to it and never understood it. I never knew why anyone would possibly want to do that. It's insane. So I'm sitting in this first meeting and I'm just shaking and crying, and I didn't say I was an alcoholic. I said I was just, I'm just trying to figure this out, man. And they were very kind to me, and just, you know, told me their stories, which sounded very, very similar to mine. And I remember Zach was at the first meeting. He's a Triangle regular, and he gave me, the next morning at the Triangle, gave me a framed serenity prayer, which I still have sitting on my dresser at home. And I was so beaten at that point that, you know, I'd never had any religious upbringing. I never had any, I didn't know what spirituality was. I didn't know what it meant. I, you know, but I was so beaten down that I was going to try it. You know, the God word offended me. And it was partly because I had a sister who was a born-again Christian. She converted when I was in high school, and this is when I was starting to cause problems and get out of control. And she would kindly tell me about God's will and things like that, and I was just like, "Get the fuck out of my room." And and I didn't understand it and was, you know, very fearful. So finding out finally that, you know, my way wasn't working, I thought this would be okay to try something new. And right after that second meeting, I was packed off and went to Sundown Ranch over in Yakima for treatment for 3 weeks. And that was exactly what I needed. It was, I needed to be sequestered away. Oh God, I'm like 15, Jesus, I haven't been talking that long. So it was good for me to be away from society and just like in this place, which was focused entirely 100% on recovery, because I had just too many distractions on the outside. I couldn't handle it. And so it was really great for me to be there and just have this focus. And my friend who was the one who got sober, he drove me to Yakima. And I remember being on the way there, being very afraid of what was going to happen in there. And I was like, is this going to be a bunch of God shit? I mean, seriously. And he just kind of shrugged and he said, "We have this prayer in AA. It's the Serenity Prayer." And he tells me this prayer in the car while we're on the way to treatment. As I'm being driven to treatment, is my first contact with spirituality. And you know, he tells me this: "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." And that suddenly made a lot of sense to me. It seemed like I could use this to help me. This would make sense in my life. And I could see how this is almost like a decision tree. You know, you have these, you have a problem in your life, and you can look at it like, can I accept this? So you come down this path, accept. Problems up here, you know, if I can't accept it, I come down here. Can I change it? And somewhere in the middle is God that's telling you which path to go on it. But I could see it as this is, I could kind of trick myself into praying through this because I could see it as a practical way to solve problems in my life. So that that got me started. And I, you know, get out of treatment, immediately get into AA, get a sponsor, do the steps, do, you know, do everything. My life starts getting better, keep changing, keep growing, I'm open to new experiences. I'm willing to do this because I really was bankrupt. I really was out of ideas. I was out of personal resources to be able to handle any of this. And it led me to, you know, it beat me into the willingness to accept whatever direction I was being given. And so I went along for a couple of years through the program. I was going to Burke Avenue Men's, as Jesse's mentioned, and I felt better. I felt my life was getting better, but I felt I was on the outside still. I was kind of on the outside circle of the cool kids in the middle who seemed to have the inside jokes and knew what was going on. And, you know, I'd gotten a million phone numbers from people from different meetings. When, you know, you first show up, they give you the book with all the numbers in it, but I'd never used them. So I decided for myself, like, I need to be more connected, so I'm going to start calling people. And so I made a game out of it to make it easier for myself, and so I started this Dial-A-Drunk program. And I would be, and I had all these numbers, you know, because I'd get them at every, you know, the new guy, I'd get his number. And so I would be walking to work in the morning, and I would just pick somebody, and I'd call him up, and I'd just say, "Hey, this is Jeff, you're the contestant this morning on Dial-A-Drunk, how you doing?" And it made it an easy way for me to talk to someone because, you know, they could see the joke of it and just be okay with it. And then we'd talk about something real or we wouldn't. And I got to know people this way, you know, and I got to be more connected with other people. And I totally recommend this to, you know, guys I sponsor now all the time. Just, like, make a game of it. And it takes the weight out of trying to talk to somebody. And then when you really need to talk to somebody, you've already made that connection. You know, you don't have to panic about, like, oh, my God, who's this person in the book who I've never spoken to before? I need to talk to somebody, you know. And if you've already made that connection, it makes it much easier. So anyway, that opens up a whole new program for me because now I'm connected with people. And I'm understanding other people, and I'm able to talk to other people. And I'm making friends, and I'm... my life has really become full of the program. Like, all of my friends essentially are alcoholics, which I guess qualifies me for Al-Anon, so I probably should think about that. But I get to a point where my sponsor and I have gone through the steps. We're kind of stagnant, you know. We kind of, you know, he was, you know, a year or so ahead of me in the program, so it's, we didn't know where to go at that point and didn't really know what to do. And I was feeling like I needed to grow more. I didn't want to stay in this groove. And part of what triggered this is I'd had my fifth, my five-year birthday, and a friend of mine at Burke Avenue, Dr. Sam, who now lives in California, he's like, "Oh, five years, 5 to 8. That's the suicide years. Welcome." And I'm just like, "Sweet." So I didn't feel like that was, a path I was going to go down, but it triggered me to think like, I need to stay active. I need to keep growing. I need to change things up and make sure that I'm expanding my spiritual life. So I shortly that after that, I'm at Abigail's. I've been going there more frequently, and a guy was chairing that day, and he had this spiritual aura about him. He had calmness and peace about him, and he spoke of spiritual things. And I really related to that, and I was like, that's what I need. And so I fired my other sponsor, got this guy to sponsor me, and we have had for the last couple of years a really interesting relationship that's completely based around spiritual progress, spiritual growth. And what we did was, I brought a big book. You guys might have seen one of these. we jumped it right into We Agnostics, and that's, step two and three essentially. And he had his sponsor come do this sort of intensive second step thing with me on a Saturday morning. This is like how willing I am to grow more is to, I'm going to spend like 3 hours on my Saturday morning having this guy tell me about God and spiritual practice. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. Let's do this. And so we sit down, and the first things we're looking at is on bottom of page 44, it talks about if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago, but we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. And I was, I thought I was good. I thought I understood what right and wrong were. And so it was like, why do I need all this other stuff? I get it. But it didn't work for me, obviously. And so said we could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might. But the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, our thinking, our brain, our ideas, this lump sitting on my neck, is as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed us utterly. How did they fail? Not a little bit, but utterly. And that was what he was hammering home to me, is this: our human resources do not work to fix what this malady is that we have. So our ideas and our education, we can be as smart as we want, we can understand this stuff intellectually, but thinking about it doesn't fix it. So that requires another source of power. And we continue through this chapter and like just hitting points that I'd read 20 times before, but I'm now seeing in a different light, and I'm seeing them as profound. And this is something that's happening to me a lot lately, is I'm having these profound things appear to me, and they're very simple. And I think that that's, the most profound things in life are simple. And somehow we've like looked around them or through them or just didn't understand it at first because we're trying to complicate it. And that's certainly something I did. So these little simple things are suddenly popping up, and there's this idea of more about the failure of our human resources. This is page 50, where in the face of collapse and despair, in the face of total failure of their human resources, they found a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. And that I wanted that. I needed that. I needed a new sense of direction. I needed new power. And this happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. And once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making such heavy going of life. Well, why they were making such heavy going of life, not why life was mistreating them, which is how I was viewing it. It's like, I am the one doing this. I'm the one making heavy going of life. And that became profound to me as well, that this is the problem is of my own making. And this made me think back to my sponsor before that. I had this time, I had a pretty shaky relationship with my family. They all live in Colorado. Well, some of them I'm good with, some of them I'm not so good with. But I was having to go back there because my dad was in the hospital, and I'm playing in my head all the conversations that are going to happen with my mom, and that are going to happen with my brother, and the fight that's going to ensue, and how I'm going to tell them that they need to do something different. They've got to fix their lives. They've got to, and because I'm so spiritual, because I've got this figured out. And so, like, listen to me, kids, you're going to get this. And so, So I've got this plan all in place of how I'm gonna just wreak havoc at home because of them or whatever. And I'm telling this to my sponsor at the time, and he just turns to me and goes, "You can make this suck if you want to." I can make this suck? And that suddenly rang a bell for me, another profound revelation. I am the one who can make this suck, which means I can also make it good. You can flip that coin and take the other side of it. And so this trip home, I had that in my head, like, it's me. I don't have to do this. I don't have to be the one causing this trouble. And right around that same time, before I went home, I heard in a meeting a guy saying, you know, the way he worked the program was, let God be God, let Jeff be Jeff, let everyone else be everyone else. And I saw that what I was doing with my family was telling them how they needed to live their lives, and I saw how they were miserable and they needed to do something different. And that revelation to me was, you know what, I can't change them. I can't change what they're doing. And even better than that, it's not my job to change them. They have their own whatever. They have a higher power, they don't, but it isn't me, and it's not my job to take care of that. And so having that new attitude when I went home this time, I stayed in a hotel. I didn't stay in codependent manner, as I like to call it. And I didn't try to fix them, and I let them be what they were going to be. I was in and out of there, and I behaved in a way that didn't cause more damage. And that was huge progress for me, just to show up and not cause wreckage. So that was, you know, these little bits along the way are happening. So anyway, I'm back to this. We're going through this We Agnostics part, and the part that really, really got me was page 55, where it was talking about, you know, people saying the Wright brothers could never fly, this intellect still trying to overtake the spirit. And it says here that, yet we had been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but we liked to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It's already in us. We already have this. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. And it's, you know, I see that as we're obscuring it by our behavior. We're obscuring by our belief in our righteousness. We're obscuring it by our belief that other people need to do what we tell them to do. But deep down inside, we all have that fundamental idea of God. And this is where my sponsor, he harps on this a lot, is that we are born perfect. We are perfect beings when we're born, and we corrupt that as we go through life, through our what we learn from parents, what we learn from society, what we learn from television. And the beliefs that we form around that corrupt our perfection. And so his thing now is our suffering is directly proportional to our disbelief in that perfection. And it's not about perfectionism. It's not about the meeting topic from yesterday, you know, of like how we try to become perfect. It's we already are, and we already have that within us. And that's what this on page 55 says to me, is that we've for this, you know, for faith in a power greater than ourselves, and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. And that brought me incredible comfort to know that it's another one of these paradoxes, I think, in AA, where, you know, we are not God, but we have the fundamental idea of God within us. And that started to change me. You know, that started to make me see things a little bit differently, that we have the ability to be better people than we are. Or not intrinsically better, but we can behave better. We can make things better for other people. We can make our lives more wholesome, and you know, just whatever that means to us. And we all know what that, you know, to ourselves, what that means. And so this was a big revelation to me. And then as things, you know, I'm going along and I'm feeling pretty good, I'm kind of passing this along to sponsees and I'm trying to give them ways to help their lives get better. And then at Abigail's Ghost, there's a member there who's named Angel, and she's totally awesome. And she talked about coming to terms with what God means to her. And she had her sponsor gave her this exercise to write down the characteristics that she wanted. And, you know, you guys may have heard this or done this yourselves, but again, profound to me. Was she would have, her sponsor would have her write down the characteristics she would want in a parent and the characteristics she would want in a partner and in a brother and in a sister. And so she makes this list, and it's, you know, forgiving, compassionate, loving, joyful, funny, these kind of things. And then she totally makes me emotional because it's just so profound. But her sponsor then writes, God is, at the top of that piece of paper. And so that becomes her vision of a higher power. And then the trick that her sponsor plays is, this is how you get to show up. This is now how you get to behave in life. And that that really resonated with me. And it made so much sense for how to practical spirituality, how to behave in a spiritual way that is going to help me connect to other people. And to me, that's the basis of spirituality, is that connection. It's the connection that we feel to other people. And to have that list, you know, to have that list in mind of what are these, how can I behave in the world that matches the intent I have for other people? And whether they're going to do it or not is, you know, that's not up to me to decide, but I can be that way, and I can choose to be that way. So, time goes on. I'm working in this job where I've been there forever. I got a marketing degree in college for no good reason. it was kind of a random decision. And so I'd been working in this career for 20 some years and wondering why I'd never, like, I've had this low grade dissatisfaction with it the entire time. And I kind of look back on how, you know, I never really meant to do this. This was just kind of the easiest path I had at the time. And so I'm faking my way through this career and my life, and it's not healthy for me. And I'm complaining to this counselor I have about this, and I had tried to, you know, I was working at a law firm for 11 years as a creative manager, which is an oxymoron of a job if you've ever heard of it. And I was complaining not only to this counselor but pretty much anyone who I could corner about, like, how shitty this job was. And and I'm telling this, you know, I was trying to find similar jobs in other companies, like at a software company or something more progressive or interesting or whatever, but I'm, you know, I feel like the skills don't translate because I've been in this place for 11 years, and, you know, it doesn't make sense to another company to see what I've done on my resume, and it doesn't fit into their way of doing things. And so I'm telling this counselor that, and she's like, well, do you think another 5 years there will help that? And then she's, you know, follows that with, you know, spending 11 years at a job you don't like might indicate a problem. And I was like, you're absolutely right. And finally, you know, I'm having people reveal these truths to me, you know, that are like, I can't see myself. And so that triggers me to start thinking about, well, what do I really want to do? And around the same time, I had tried to escape the firm I was working at by getting the exact same job at a different firm. And I knew the person who was hiring, and I'm like, all right, I'm in. This is going to completely fix everything, because I'll be in a different cube. And so I go through this interview process, and it's down to me and one other candidate, and I'm just like, I'm in, this is great. And then I get the call that I don't get the job, and I can't believe this. And I was like, why, what happened? And they're like, well, we didn't feel like you were enthusiastic about the firm or the position. And I start arguing with her about this. yes, I was. What are you talking about? And then I kind of calmed down. I'm like, okay, well, thanks anyway. And then I realized my authentic self showed up at that interview. I was not enthusiastic about that job. I was enthusiastic about getting out of the one I had, but I was not enthusiastic about going to this one and helping them do whatever they wanted me to do. And so that made me think, like, maybe this isn't where I'm supposed to be. Like, these are things being revealed to me. And I remember after I didn't get that job, I went to Berg Avenue, and this guy, Charlie, was there. And I, you know, told him I'd had this interview. And he's like, what happened with the job, man? And I was like, I didn't get it. They didn't think I was enthusiastic. And he's like, dude, you're spiritually fit. What do you need with that stupid job? And I was like, you're right, Charlie. And, So I let go of that, and so by doing that, I stopped fighting against this job that I had. I started realizing that, like, I don't have to. The big thing was my job there was to do what they wanted me to do, not what I thought I wanted to do there. And by just finally accepting that, that gave me peace enough in my mind that I could be open to other possibilities. And this is all happening as I'm talking to this counselor, and I'm, you know, deciding, like, this something different has to happen. And my friend Matt, who's here, is had gone through this chemical dependency professional program, and so I've been talking to him. And I'm like, this is, and I've gotten so much help from counselors in my life that I'm thinking, this is what I want to do. I want to start helping people. I want to turn pro. And so I've gotten this idea, and then I go to Abigail's, like, right after I'm making this kind of decision, and there's a woman there who also is a counselor. She's chairing the day I show up, and she's reading this story. It's called Empty on the Inside, and this is what she was reading when I came in. I spent my life acting as if, either acting as if I knew. I didn't ask teachers questions in school. They might find out I didn't know the answer, or acting as if I didn't care. I always felt as though everyone else had been given the directions to life, and I had been somewhere else when God was handing them out. To me, you either knew how to do something or you didn't. You could play the piano or you couldn't. You were a good ball player or you weren't. And that's exactly how I felt, that you're either supposed to know this stuff or you don't. And then it says, I don't know where I learned this the attitude that it wasn't all right not to know, but it was certainly in my life, and it almost killed me. The concept of set a goal, work for a goal, achieve the goal was foreign to me. And that absolutely was true for me. You either had it or you didn't, and if you didn't, you couldn't let on, or you might look bad. And so I'm starting to feel like pieces are falling into place. I'm being shown signs now. I can no longer ignore what's happening in front of my face. And it's all because I've gotten rid of so much of this crap that was going on in my head that I'm able to allow other influence in. And so I talked to her after the meeting, and I was like, hey, I'm thinking of starting this program at Seattle Central, and in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, because I'm the job I'm in, I'm making six figures. It's like a, on paper, great job, and I want to walk away from it. And so I'm expecting people to just go, "What are you? You're an idiot. Don't do that." And I go tell this woman, "This is my plan," and she's just immediately supportive and immediately saying, "You'd be great at this. You should do this." And you know, it turns out every person I talk to, inside and outside the program, tells me that same thing. And it was all me thinking, like, I'm going to be a failure at this. I needed to know it before I got there. And so I started taking the classes. I end up quitting that job in September. And, I'm going to school full time right now. And you know, it's just such a different path for me. I went from this law firm where I was, it's a 2,000, maybe 2,500 lawyers at this point. It's a ridiculously huge, monstrous conglomerate of greed and corruption. and I the people I worked with were in other countries and other cities and states, and I never saw them. You know, I would talk to them on the phone or via email, and it's all very disconnected and impersonal and awful for me. I mean, people thrive there and they love it, but it wasn't for me. And then I get into this thing where I'm in this school program, and it's all very, very local, and it's with people who care about helping other people. And it's with people who are interested in, you know, helping cure some human suffering. And at the firm, they were creating it, you know. And so I now I'm down to this level where it's going to be, you know, one-on-one, like working with another person, not some entity somewhere else, you know. And so this is, it's such a huge change for me to be in that position to make an effect on people potentially. I haven't done anything yet. I'm still in school. But to somehow help people with that. And through the school process, there's been more of these profound revelations that I've had where I'm learning things about myself and about spirituality through an academic endeavor. And a couple things I learned, well, there's this... Dr. Brené Brown, I feel like I'm the last person who heard of her, but she is a social worker, doctor of social work. She's done this TED talk that's very popular about vulnerability and shame. And I saw this as part of a school class, and she talks about people who have this shame that they're kind of, it's kind of this, you know, thing where I don't know where it came from. It's just like I've always felt like not enough, and this is... The basic feeling is essentially, I am not good enough. And whether people are telling you that or not, this is how I felt. And so that's part of the thing we try to mask with our use, with addiction, with, and you know, she wasn't specifically talking about drug addiction, but it could be anything. It could be food, it could be sex, it could be shopping, it could be whatever it is. We try to selectively numb those things we don't like. So we try to numb the shame or numb the pain, numb the anger. But when we do that, you cannot selectively numb emotions. So when you do that, you end up numbing happiness, and you end up numbing joy and gratitude. And so you become flat. And that was what I became when I was out there using. It's just completely emotionless, flat person. And so this made a lot of sense to me. And so, you know, this is something I'm seeing as another revelation. And the cure for that is connecting to other human beings, you know. The cure for that is to be vulnerable enough to be able to talk to somebody and tell them what's going on with you. And to, on the other side of it, listen to somebody who's having trouble and being able to empathize with them and to see the world as they see it. And these are things that I'm learning. These are things that I'm discovering how to do. And I, you know, when I was out there drinking and using, if you asked me what my problem was, I would have said other people. And that's what I believed. The root of my problem was everyone else. They didn't understand me. They wouldn't leave me alone. They wouldn't let me do what I wanted to do. And this was the problem. And I, when I was in Hawaii at a meeting, I got this old-timer there. Was handing out these stickers, and I got it and stuck it on my big book, and it says, "It's not them." And that has really stuck with me. It's like I can, and this is, you know, the creation of my own suffering, that idea that's, you know, it's not somebody else doing it. And now what I've come to discover is that the people used to be my problem, and now they are my solution. And it is the connection with those others that gives me a closeness to those. It gives me a chance to practice that list of characteristics that I want to have and those things that I want out of other people. And being in touch with that, and it's, you know, I can tell my story about, you know, all the fucked up things I did, all the bad behavior and all the damage I did. And it's emotionless, you know, it's just a story. But when I talk about the joy and I talk about, you know, I talk about the good things that happen in life, I get very emotional because it's things that I didn't allow to happen forever. And I didn't allow this stuff to come out. And I was doing that, you know, selective numbing that killed everything. And so for me now, the big spiritual awakening that I've had is that people are the solution. People are what get me where I want to be. And here's this really profound thing that I just remembered was another thing that happened in class. There was this guest speaker we had who was talking about nonviolent communication, which I had no idea what that meant. And she gets up in front of the class and asks people to say what are some basic human needs. And so people list off things like shelter, acceptance, love, compassion, you know, things like that. And she writes these on the board, and then she says, you know, we can take these pretty much anywhere in the world, and people are going to give us essentially the same list, right? So we can all agree that this is what people are looking for. So she said that we can take this to the next step where we can picture all communication as being either please or thank you. And it's please help me get one of these things, or thank you for helping me get one. And if I can take that into my, you know, my real world, into my communications with, particularly with my wife, and I, you know, she's saying something I don't want to hear, but what she's really saying is help me feel accepted, or help me feel validated. Those kind of things. And if I'm able to see communication in that way, it changes my life. You know, it changes the interactions I have with people. And so that was another, you know, incredibly profound revelation in just how to deal with people in the world. And I guess the most recent one I had was another thing through school was this this presentation a doctor was giving on addiction. And it was I was talking to Ed and Matt about this earlier, but Matt and I went to this, and it was Dr. Gabor Mate, and he's a physician, and he does a lot of work with addiction in Vancouver, and he works with the heroin addicts and the Insight clinics where they, you know, it's harm reduction theory where they let people shoot up heroin and they're monitored by a doctor so they don't overdose, and, you know, just like these minor things to try to make people's lives better when they're horribly addicted to things. And his description of this was, you know, addiction is an effect of human suffering. And so people are in distress in their lives, and so they want to soothe that distress. Or they're in pain, and they want to soothe that pain. And so the question that we should be asking is not why is there addiction, but why is there pain? And that was incredibly profound to me. And so I feel like that becomes the key, really, to spirituality. And the key to human connection is to try to answer that question for people. How do you help them get to the root of that? How do you help them see why am I in pain? And it could be anything. It can go back to that vulnerability. It can go back to the feeling of shame of not being enough. It can be abuse. It can be deep-seated whatever is going on. But what better way of getting in touch with that list of God's will, as I want to say it is now, this is what I've discovered God's will is to behave in those ways of loving, compassionate, joyful, all of those things. And you can get to those by helping others discover the source of their pain and helping them to get through it. And so that's kind of where I'm at right now with how spirituality works for me. And that's where I'm at. And I feel that, you know, I was doing this service position at my home group at Abigail's. I became the inside service coordinator, which means I'm the guy who gets to wrangle people to take the daily service positions. And so that meant, so there's 8 days, there's 8 meetings a week there. And so I had to go to every one of those for 2 weeks to announce that the positions were being drawn and then do the drawing the next week. And my, knee-jerk reaction to that was just like, this is bullshit. I don't want to go to every one of these. And so I ended up going to them. And what happened was I had to get up in front of everyone every day and make these announcements. And so people started to know me. And people got to see who I was and start to connect me with Abigail's, with sobriety, and with hopefully some sense of calm and peace and whatever. So through that, I got to meet a lot of people and a lot of new people who I'd never talked to because they're the ones that are making the coffee or being the greeters at the meeting and these, and the ones who sign up for these things. And so I, met 25 new people during this time. And so now I have first name basis with them and I know them as much as you can in that little brief interaction. But I remember shortly after that going in, this was just like a week or so ago, going into Abigail's on a Friday. And I walk in and I see this guy. And I'm like, hey, Rico. Hey, John. Hey, Ed, whoever, and I know almost everyone in that meeting. And that was such a joyful thing to be to have that connection with all those people. And that's when I started seeing that these people are my solution. These people are my connection to that higher power. And to be able to stay connected like that doesn't happen every day for me. I can drift away pretty easily. And so coming to something like this, where I can now be connected with all of you, and I can be making new friends here, reconnecting with people I haven't seen in a while, and being part of this whole thing where everybody is trying to get better. I heard a friend in Burke Avenue said this, and I've stolen it from him, but I'm like, if you're in here trying to get better, you're cool enough to be my friend. And so I can, have a lot of new friends that way. And the last thing I'll read to you is the end of another story in the back of the big book. It's at the end of Because I'm an Alcoholic. And this one's very emotional for me too, so be prepared. This is a woman who wrote this story, and she says, AA is my home now, and it is everywhere. I go to meetings when I travel here in foreign countries, and the people are family. I can know because of what we share. As I write this in my 28th year of sobriety, I'm amazed to look back and remember the woman or child I was then, to see how far I've come out of the abyss. Alcoholics Anonymous has enabled me to move from fantasies about what I might do with my life into living it, one day at a time. Did anybody have fantasies sitting on the bar stool about what they were going to do, travels they were going to do, like inventions they were going to make? I had a friend, Carl. We would sit at the bar Thursday night, and that was our night to dream. And we would have the idea about the Winnebago we were going to buy and park in front of different people's houses every night so we could plug into their electricity and like bring the party to them and how grateful they would be because of that. So that one never came to fruition, thankfully. In my first move that was not a geographic, I left the city and moved to the country. I left research and became a gardener. I discovered that I am a lesbian and that I love women. Sure. I'm fulfilling a longtime dream of writing fiction that's being published. But these are things I do, aspects of the life I'm living in sobriety. This is all doing. These are things, these are outward manifestations of how my life has gotten better. But the most precious discovery is who I really am. Like all of us, a being far beyond any of the ego selves, any of the fantasies I'd made up. And that's getting back to that idea of the being born perfect, being back to that, the essential human, the being, the human being, not the human doing. The sense of being different, which had long plagued me, disappeared when I saw the threads that run through all of us. Sharing our stories, our feelings, it is the areas where we are the same that impress me. The differences are but delightful flourishes on the surface, like different colored costumes, and I enjoy them. But the basic ways we are human, the basic ways we simply are, stand out to me now. I came to see that we are all really one, and that I no longer feel alone. And that's what I've, that really tells how I feel right now as part of this society and as part of this group today. So thank you for allowing me to be part of it.